This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Saturday, December 17th, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. President Biden is pledging new partnerships with African nations.
What Biden has to do now is he's got to really make the case not to the Africans, but to U.S. companies. Why Africa matters, why it's important, why it's a good destination.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. What did the so-called Twitter files reveal? Your take may depend on your politics, but either way, some Republican lawmakers say something should be done. The question is what? And should any future rules apply to all social media companies?
So they want to recover trust. I do think a greater degree of transparency about the decision-making processes that they're using, I think, would go a long way.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. The United States is all in on Africa. That was President Biden's message this week to leaders from nearly 50 African nations who traveled here to Washington for a U.S.-African Leaders Summit.
Together, we can deliver a world that is healthier and safer, more equal, more just, more prosperous, and more filled with opportunity for everyone.
The Biden administration is not the first White House to assert a focus on Africa, but the administration says there is a new commitment of follow-through, creating a new Africa-centric post, a special presidential representative for implementation of the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. I talked about the summit and the importance of the U.S.-African relationship with Cameron Hudson. He is a senior associate with the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and was the director of African Affairs on the National Security Council during the Bush administration.
Well, I think it's of growing importance, quite frankly, for a number of reasons. You know, the first of which is that back in April, when the United States tried to kind of rally the world to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we saw a lot of ambivalence on the part of African countries. Only six joined to condemn, most abstained. And I think that was a real wake-up call to Washington that if you want to be the leader of the free world, you have to lead and you have to build diplomatic coalitions to do that. And so in part, this is an effort to demonstrate to the Africans that we are committed to them and to share our interests and our values with them. But I think also we're looking at things like the global supply chain for minerals, especially those minerals that are going to power electric vehicles and the 21st century economy. Many of them are located in Africa and Africa alone. And the Chinese already have the market cornered on many of them. And so increasingly, there are real kind of economic security reasons why we need to be more invested and interested in Africa, not just in those supply chains, but in the governance structures that enable us to work with those countries. So I think we're seeing Africa kind of rise in importance right now.
What can the U.S. offer? Because you correctly point out, right, that there is a growing influence from China in Africa, growing influence from Russia in Africa. So I would imagine it's the job of the United States diplomats to say, here's why aligning with us is in your interest. What is that offer then that the U.S. can give?
Well, I think that the offer is one that's challenging right now, because what we offer is a set of shared values, values of democracy, values of transparency, and equality. But the problem is that often comes across as preachy or lecturing from the United States. And that's certainly not a message that they get from China. China is kind of all about the business, mm-hmm. and it has created a kind of foreign policy structure that very neatly aligns with its overseas investment platform. And we don't really have that yet. So, you know, Washington can't direct John Deere to go sell Nigeria farm equipment, and we can't tell Cisco to go sell routers in Angola. China can do that with its private enterprises, and we can't. And so what Biden has to do now is he's got to really make the case, not to the Africans, but to U.S. companies, why Africa matters, why it's important, why it's a good destination for U.S. investment. And if he can't do that, then we're going to have a very difficult time competing with the Chinese.
So, I mean, that might answer the question I was going to ask, which is one of the questions that came up this week at the White House, which is that, you know, this is not the first administration to try and pivot and forge these relationships in Africa. Certainly it started with your work at the Bush administration, but the criticism has been, you know, the U.S. has these types of summits, they have these types of engagements, and then nothing kind of happens. So, you know, what is the follow through here? What is the next step after you have a big summit like this, bringing all of these African leaders here to Washington?
Yeah, and that's a great question. We were criticized back in 2014 at the first summit that we did that Obama put together with the African countries where there was no follow through. And so one thing the administration has done now is they've already announced the appointment of a kind of special advisor who will be responsible for the follow up on all of the commitments and promises made so that the administration can kind of give itself a report card in a year's time or 2 years' time about how well it is following through with the commitments that have been made. But, you know, honestly, one of the challenges that we have, and it's a big one, is the commitments that we have made here this week. Many of them are going to be very hard to kind of point to and quantify. When we talk about making commitments to strengthening institutions and good governance, that's hard to put your finger on. But with China, it's real easy to point out the road or the bridge or the airport or the soccer stadium or the presidential palace that was built by Chinese money. And so, you know, we're kind of comparing apples and oranges here. And the problem is that the oranges are really paying dividends in a way that that the commitments that we're making are not.
So, I mean, as we look ahead now, new Congress coming in, the Republican-led House, is there going to be that willingness, do you think, to have U.S. aid, U.S. investment in Africa?
Well, I think that there will be. I mean, there has been traditionally a kind of a bipartisanship around Africa policy for many years, going back to the Clinton administration. But I think what we're seeing now is actually an advantage for Republicans, because what the Africans are telling us now is we don't want aid. We want trade. We want businesses to come here. We want to develop through a partnership built around business. And I think that that's an attractive opportunity for Republican members to do more to create those incentives to allow U.S. businesses to go overseas. We are in the very early stages of trying to do that. The Trump administration created something called the Development Finance Corporation, which is intended to kind of meet the Chinese at their game and to provide political risk insurance and concessional lending to U.S. businesses to go overseas. But it's still in its infancy. And so we really need to redouble those efforts to try to make that possible and increase the budget of the DFC. If we can do that, then I think Africans will want to do business with the United States.
You mentioned the former president, President Trump. You know, he had also been criticized for sort of disparaging remarks that he's made about developing countries, some African countries. Is that part of the challenge for the U.S. now to try and sort of reset some of those relationships and kind of show a sustainability in these relationships, a lasting nature to these relationships?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's still a kind of hangover from those years that the Biden administration is trying to work through right now. There were certainly a lot of hurt feelings, not just by some of the comments that were made, but really because you saw Washington under the last administration take a step back. President Trump did not go to Africa. He's the first president since Ronald Reagan not to take a trip to Africa. And the Africans notice when you show up. The Chinese president goes to Africa every year. And we haven't had a presidential visit to Africa since Obama. And so those symbols of the relationship really do matter, and they're indelible marks that have been forgotten because it's been so long since we've been there. So Biden is under pressure to go. The summit was a first step, but there's more to do.
I think that there is an expectation that President Biden does travel to the continent next year. What would your advice be to sort of figure out kind of what the itinerary of that? I mean, we talk about Africa. It's not a monolith. It is a lot of different countries, a lot of different regions, a lot of different challenges and priorities. You know, how do you kind of have a cohesive strategy as you sort of have these visits to Africa and figure out sort of where you need to be, who you need to be speaking to?
Well, I think the thing that differentiates Washington from, you know, Beijing, for example, is that we are not just motivated by our interests, we're motivated by our values. And I think that Washington and Biden is going to want to go someplace that isn't just in the U.S. interest, but that has a reflection of U.S. values and shared values with the United States. So countries that are practicing democracy, that are practicing good governance, where you know, women are treated equally, where human rights are respected. And quite frankly, we've seen a retrenchment on the African continent over the last 10 years in places where that can be said. And so sadly, there are fewer countries with a kind of unmitigated record of success on democracy and human rights right now. He's going to have to go places that I think reflect those values, but also tackle some of the big challenges and meet the Chinese where they are the most competitive. So places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, which controls much of the mineral supply chain and where China already has a big footprint, and where the country is kind of struggling with democracy. That's going to have to be a place that he goes to plant a flag.
How important is Africa as we think about sort of national security, as you think about, I guess, what we used to refer to as the war on terrorism?
Well, it's very important. You know, the Chinese, for example, are looking at establishing a naval base in the Atlantic on the west coast of Africa somewhere, and so that would present a pretty sizable strategic threat to Washington to have China with an Atlantic naval presence. Similarly, with respect to terrorism is growing at a rapid pace, the highest pace in the world in Africa right now. That's putting pressure on populations to move. Many of those migrants are going north towards Europe, putting pressure on our European allies. But the Atlantic trade is binding us very closely to Africa, and we can see already smuggling routes established off the west coast of Africa coming into Latin America and to the United States. So as the world gets smaller, the problems in Africa do come closer to our shores, and they present problems not only for us indirectly, but to our European and other allies in even more direct ways.
A very important conversation. Sounds like it's good that they had this conversation here in Washington this week. Cameron Hudson, appreciate your insight, your analysis as we navigate all of these geopolitical questions that arise from time to time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Twitter's new CEO, Elon Musk, has released internal company documents to certain independent journalists from prior years. The so-called Twitter files, Musk said, were meant to show how decisions were made and to show government involvement in those decisions. Government officials did have access to Twitter employees, but in the first installment of the Twitter files, which focused on executives' decisions to downplay a story about Hunter Biden's laptop, it did not come with specific requests from then-presidential candidate Biden's team to ban the story. It did show requests to remove certain tweets, mostly containing risque pictures reportedly from the laptop. The additional installments from the files show how Twitter de-amplified certain, oftentimes more conservative accounts, like Stanford Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who was tweeting out information about the harm of COVID lockdowns on children.
If you have
Twitter is suppressing that discussion. They're suppressing science.
And one Twitter file thread from former New York Times journalist Barry Weiss showed how top executives struggled with the decision to permanently ban former President Trump after the January 6th Capitol riot. Weiss highlighted a conversation that included doubt that any policy violations had occurred. Fox News correspondent Mike Emanuel spoke about this with George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley.
Less than 90 minutes later, Vijay Gadde, then head of policy and trust, appears persistent and was met with suggestions from employees that Trump's tweet may have violated Twitter's glorification of violence policy if you interpreted the phrase American patriots to refer to the rioters.
You have people that sit there and they dress up personal bias as a way of protecting others from harm.
Many media outlets and some Democrats have said there's no smoking gun here in these files or big revelation. Some Republicans, like Georgia Congressman Barry Loudermilk, disagree.
It's earth-shattering information that should concern every American, regardless of which side of the aisle you're sitting on.
House Republicans on the Judiciary Committee have said they plan to investigate social media impacts on the 2020 election, along with the Justice Department's warning to those companies at the time to be on the lookout for disinformation when they take control of the majority next year.
There are no shocking revelations in this.
Jerry Baker is the editor-at-large and a columnist at The Wall Street Journal.
There's no sudden piece of news that we didn't know about relating to a particular intervention, perhaps by the government or whatever, or by somebody on, you know, getting Twitter to do something at its behest. But the Twitter files are nonetheless very revealing in a most important, in one overwhelmingly important way, which is that they give us, in a quite unusual way, it's not often that companies open up themselves and their internal documentation for examination in this way. Obviously, sometimes they do, as is in the case here, when a new CEO takes over and wants to change the company. But it is quite unusual to do that. But what this reveals, what this unusual exercise reveals, it provides confirmation and really colorful detail of what we've really always known or suspected all along, which is that companies like Twitter have for many, many years, many of these in powerful, and it's a very powerful platform, Twitter. It's not, people talk about it's just a private company, it can do what it's like. Yes, it's true. It is a private company. It can do what it's like. The First Amendment protects it. But it's a powerful company. It has enormous reach. And again, like so many of these powerful technology and media companies, we know now that it is very dominated by people of a particular ideological mindset who basically take the view, not all of them, I should say, and there are some heroes in this story here, but most of the people, especially most of the powerful people at Twitter, made decisions. Whether it was about the decision to suppress the Hunter Biden laptop story, whether it was about the decision to get Donald Trump off Twitter after January 6th, whether it was about some of the other issues that have been raised, they made decisions really based on what was a very strongly progressive ideological view of the world, which they not only wanted to pursue themselves, but they wanted to pursue it in a way that would make sure that no other voices, no really powerful dissenting voices could really be heard to challenge that view of the world. So that's the fundamental thing. We've learned how a really important tech media company operates to pursue and to advocate and to disseminate a particular view of the world, which is progressive, left-wing, and is hostile to alternative views.
It appears with the various files so far, one thing we can glean is the decision makers at Twitter struggled with how to make certain decisions. I mean, there's some screenshot evidence of emails, Slack messages, questioning some of the decisions being made. But in the end, limits were placed on some, I guess, more conservative accounts, right? Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, Charlie Kirk, Dan Bongino, even libs of TikTok to a certain extent. We refer to it as shadow banning. They at Twitter apparently were calling it visibility filtering. Did you see evidence in these Twitter files about how they decided whom should be on the receiving end of deamplification or this visibility filtering?
Yeah, very good. And your terminology there is very good and very precise. You're absolutely right. It's kind of Orwellian the way in which these companies, deny what they are doing is what we all know they're doing by giving it these sort of weird, complex circumlocutions. It was shadow banning, as we call it. That is essentially suppressing the reach of certain topics and certain people, and you've mentioned some of them there. The reason they were doing it, Jessica, I think is quite clear, which is that They I think it's important to understand the mindset here too, which is that this is not simply a case of people having a particular view, a whole set of policies, what we might call sort of progressive, woke, you know, culturally leaning in that direction kind of ideas and views about the world and wanting to promote them. It is about a view, and this is what I was writing in my column this week, it's about a view that is actually regards other views not just as wrong or ill-informed or flawed, but as illegitimate. They regard disagreement as illegitimate, and they characterize alternative views not as alternative views, but as misinformation. So in other words, that itself is a process of delegitimization. Jay Bhattacharya, the guy you talk about in particular, who was tweeting quite a lot of important skeptical content about the received, the sort of the orthodoxies about COVID in the early days of the pandemic, who was challenging some of the lines that were being put out by most of the media and by the federal government at the time. He was, as we know now, he was de-amplified or essentially shadow banned because he was supposedly, according to these kind of little Maoists who controlled Twitter at the time, he was guilty of misinformation. This is a very, again, sort of back to the Orwellian point, this is a very dangerous thing here, because it's not just that people are, that these powerful people with great voices and a great reach and a great platform are saying, you know, this is the view we want you to hear. They are describing alternative views as false, misinformation, and actually in some ways both illegitimate and some ways fundamentally immoral. And so that's what they were doing. They were pursuing their own take on the world and delegitimizing and demonizing any alternative voices.
Jerry, it also appears the decision to ban then President Trump from the platform was considered after some noted that there was no clear policy violation. And that's what Barry Weiss tweeted out to all of us. But that in some other tweets sort of added up to something. And after January 6th, there was this company-wide pressure, as noted in the Slack channel evidence, that that many felt it was just, you know, finally time. Were there clear policies, as you read the Twitter files, that the company was abiding by on some of these decisions, like the Trump decision, or was there not actually enough information released in the Twitter files to say exactly what happened here with that decision?
Yeah, we could always use more information. We could in this particular instance. It doesn't seem to me, and Barry Weiss kind of makes this point in her account and her as she reviews the Twitter files that she was given access to, that they didn't seem to have a clear evidence of violation of their policies. They were talking about incitement to violence, which is a clear violation. You're not allowed to go on Twitter and incite to violence, supposedly. And there's some discussion of that and whether his tweets after around January the 6th and what he might have tweeted after January the 7th if he'd stayed on, whether they would have represented incitement to violence. But it wasn't clear that that was the case. You point to a very good point, Jessica. First of all, it's clear from those files that they had been essentially trying to silence Trump for a long time before that. And the sense that you get when you read the Twitter files around January 7th is that this was like a gotcha moment. They'd finally got him. And by the way, I have no particular sympathy with the president going around continuing to, you know, insist that the election was stolen and that and sort of encouraging his followers to protest and take action. I mean, he's allowed to do that. And he's also the president of the United States. I don't agree with what he did. But finding evidence that he was resorting to incitation of violence is pretty hard. And the other thing to say is that, you know, this is if it's true that they were doing this because he was somehow violating their policy, it's a very inconsistent application of the policy. They allow, you know, the president of Iran to be, or the supreme Ayatollah of Iran to go on Twitter.
This is
a man who frequently, you know, the Ayatollah frequently calls for, you know, the elimination of the state of Israel and the extermination of Jews and things like that. I mean, so they have a very inconsistent, if they are applying that policy, they have a very inconsistent inconsistent approach to it. I think the answer again is that they had been seeking for a long time to silence Donald Trump. Twitter was obviously one of the key factors in Donald Trump's rise to political prominence in 2015 and 2016, and they knew that throughout his presidency. He had enormous numbers of followers, and it was enormously influential. They didn't like a lot of what he did, and again, you can agree or disagree with that. They didn't like a lot of what he was saying on the platform, and many of people wanted to get rid of him, and they seized the opportunity of January the 6th to do so.
in the end, right, the conversation sort of coming down to this debate about, you know, this is how Twitter wants to operate, right? You referenced it. It's a private company. They do not have to guarantee our free speech. The U.S. government does. How significant is that argument? Like when we hear people say, well, something must be done. Twitter is so big now. They're such a big part of the public discourse, as are other social media companies. Does something need to be done? Or is the something that needs to be done just saying, this is a private company. If you don't like it, then you don't have to participate in it.
Yeah, I strongly lean towards the latter view, which is, I mean, I don't think, I'm very nervous about the idea of government getting involved of regulation of sort of content platforms, because, I mean, A, it's wrong in itself, and B, you know, where does it end? And as you say, we do have free speech, and the First Amendment actually explicitly says that the Congress shall make no laws to restrict the right of free speech. And these companies, they are private companies. They're owned by private individuals. They have shareholders, and they can do, you know, again, with without, as long as they're not, you know, inciting violence or breaking the law in other ways, they do have free speech. So I'm against that. I do think they're against that sort of regulation. The second thing that needs to be said is, you know, what's happened is, in a sense, the market has worked here. Elon Musk has taken as acquired Twitter, and he's changing it, and he's exposing some of the things that they did in the past that were wrong. That's good. That's an example of a self-correcting market mechanism responding to something that's clearly going wrong, where a platform like Twitter has so much power and is using it in a particular way. It's good that we have the market correction. Maybe if there is, I think the one area where, I know it's possible we could possibly clean things up a little bit from a regulatory point of view, is I think maybe there are ways in which we could encourage more transparency from these companies. We should, you know, again, as I said right at the beginning, companies don't often open themselves up in this way, and I wouldn't expect them to be obliged to. That would be, you know, they have important internal information. Nobody should have to be required to publish that. But I think if we can at least agree on some sort of a code where companies make clear what they're doing, the thing about Twitter is, Twitter didn't set itself up to be, didn't publicize itself when it started 10, 15 years ago, as a platform for progressive liberal types to promote their views and to agree with each other. It wanted to be a kind of global town square, as it called itself.
Sure.
So if there's a bit more transparent, I don't know. And again, I'm very, very reluctant ever to have the government get involved in any sort of regulation. But at least if there was some public pressure, some even market pressure, to force companies to be a little bit more transparent in terms of the way in which they are approaching content, I think that would be welcome.
Finally, Jerry, there's some bipartisan agreement that some regulations on big tech are needed. I know you've followed it and covered it. This was well before the Twitter files were released. We've been talking about, in that vein, Section 230 for, I would say, a few years now. This is the code that removes liability for a social media company, or really anybody running anything on the internet. You know, you can't hold Yelp or Google or Twitter liable for something that you or me or a third party writes. Is the answer here to remove Section 230 protections, or tweak them or alter them? Or should conservatives be careful about backing that, especially if they wanted to start up a counter to Twitter? Because actually Section 230 would probably hurt smaller companies or startups or medium-sized companies far more than they would hurt larger companies without those protections.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And again, I'm cautious about it. I generally think that, I mean, the reason I think there's a case for moving on Section 230 is that this is not a case of government imposing regulations. It's actually government essentially removing a particular concession that was given to tech companies back in the 1990s. It started off, and nobody foresaw, I think, well, few people foresaw that they would be used in this way. You know, the argument was, but tech companies were no more liable. These tech companies that became, as they became, Facebook and Twitter and Google and others, were no more responsible for the content that appeared on them. That a fax machine is responsible for the content that's sent through it. You know, by the fax machine, most of your listeners probably don't even know what a fax machine is. But those were the things we used to use in the 1990s for most of the transmission of documents and information. So they were a sort of dumb pipes is how they were described and how they liked to present themselves. They're obviously that, by the way, that's very much at odds with news organizations like yours and mine, Jessica. We are responsible for what appears on our on our air or in our page, the pages of our newspaper, and we can be sued for, or you know, or pursued by people who are unhappy with it for defamation or any other breach of, we might have breach of the law. So I think it does make sense to make content providers such as these tech companies, it does make sense to remove that. There is a risk, I agree with you, that some smaller, that may make it, the risks of liability involved for small startups maybe great. But I think that the way that would work is that the smaller the startup, probably the smaller the risk of the liability. I mean, if Facebook, Meta, the company, is held responsible for what appears on its platform, this is a multi-hundred-billion-dollar company, and it is reaching an enormous number of people, billions of people around the world every month. If some small startup comes along and is reaching, you know, a few hundred thousand people or even fewer people than that, and it's held liable, then obviously the degree of liability is going to be smaller. So I think there's a lot to be worked out here. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how these things would work, but I do think what we've seen in the last 10 years is that the protection afforded by Section 230 of that Telecommunications Act, I think, has been abused, frankly, and has got to a point where it is a nonsense and an absurdity now to think that these tech companies can simply be held completely free of any responsibility for what they are producing in terms of what they are putting in front of the eyes and the ears of hundreds of millions of people.
And Jerry, just before I let you go, very briefly, do you have suspicions now, up to your point about transparency, about Facebook, YouTube, other social media companies? Would you be interested in seeing the files on those companies in a similar vein?
Very much so. Yeah. Look, again, I'm all in favor of radical transparency. I believe I completely understand why companies don't want to do that, and there should be some protections for privacy and various other things like that. But I think it would be great. Again, I'm not suggesting there's a legal obligation. There isn't, and there shouldn't be. But I think that companies, you know, if they want to earn a bit more trust, trust is so important, Jessica, as you know, to what we do, to what journalism does, to anybody who's putting content in front of people has to be trusted. And I think if they really, these companies are not trusted, they are really no longer. Facebook has lost an extraordinary amount of trust. Twitter, you know, maybe it's recovering it a bit with Elon Musk now at the helm, but Twitter's lost a lot of trust. Google has too. If they want to recover trust, I do think a greater degree of transparency about the decision-making processes that they're using, I think, would go a long way and could actually benefit them. As painful as it might be, as it has been for some of those people who've subsequently left Twitter, as the Twitter files have been, as painful as it might be for some of those executives at some of these companies, I think in the long run, it would be in their benefit.
Gerard Baker, editor-at-large at the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, we'll take a look at both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue with our own Chad Pergram and Jackie Heinrich. Then with Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema announcing a party switch from Democrat to Independent, many wonder what this means for the state of play in the Senate in 2024. Until then, I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.